Hello and welcome to the Shakespeare Birthday Party. I'm Danny.
And I'm Grace.
And today we're kicking off a year of reading Shakespeare's plays with a discussion of one of his last works, The Tempest. We'll be following the format we'll use for most episodes. So first, we'll give a brief summary of the play. Then Grace and I will each bring up one or two sort of big picture questions that Shakespeare puts on the table. And finally, we'll discuss a couple of our favorite moments of poetic brilliance in the play. So the play was probably written around 1610 to 1611, well into the last decade of Shakespeare's life. There's a sense in which it can be read as a sort of poetic valediction on Shakespeare's part, with Prospero taking on something of the poet's voice, but we'll say more on that later. The Tempest begins with a shipwreck. Alonso, king of Naples, along with his son Ferdinand and brother Sebastian, are returning from the marriage of Claribel, Alonso's daughter, to the king of Tunis. Also on board are Antonio, the treacherous Duke of Milan, or Milan, as they pronounce it in the play, with Gonzalo the counselor and several other servants, including Trinculo, Stefano, Adrian, and Francisco. They're all caught in a powerful storm, which turns out to be the doing of Prospero, the rightful Duke of Milan, who has been living on an island for the last 12 years, since Antonio, his brother, usurped him. Prospero, by means of magical books, can control spirits, among them Ariel, who has conjured up the storm. Watching from the island, Miranda, Prospero's daughter, takes pity on whatever poor creatures must be aboard the ship, and asks her father to take pity too, if he has summoned the storm, as she suspects. He assures her that all will be well, and reveals to her their own family history, including the treachery whereby they were cast away upon the island. In addition to Ariel, we meet another of Prospero's servants, Caliban, a kind of half-man, half-monster born of Sycorax the witch, who previously held the island under her command. Caliban collects wood and water for Prospero and Miranda, and we learn that Prospero and Miranda have educated him, and that he has once tried to rape Miranda and people the island with Caliban's. The men in the shipwreck find themselves separated in a few groups on the island. Ferdinand, finding himself alone and assuming his father dead, partly because of a song that Ariel sings to him, wanders until he meets Miranda and Prospero. Ferdinand and Miranda fall in love, and Prospero sentences Ferdinand to hard labor. Elsewhere on the island, Alonso mourns the supposed death of Ferdinand, while Gonzalo, Sebastian, and Antonio discuss the utopian possibilities of such an island. Ariel casts a magical sleep upon several of the men, and Sebastian and Antonio conspire to kill Alonso and Gonzalo, though Ariel foils their plot. Stefano and Trinculo stumble upon Caliban, who becomes Stefano's drunken slave. Caliban urges Stefano to kill Prospero, become king of the island, and people it by Miranda. Ferdinand and Miranda are betrothed and undergo a kind of nuptial rite under the blessings of the goddesses Juno, Ceres, and Iris. Then Prospero recalls that Caliban, Stefano, and Trinculo are plotting to kill him, and has Ariel confound them. At last, Alonso and his company are reunited with Ferdinand, and Prospero forgives all past treachery. He commands Ariel to give the king's ship a good wind back to Naples, and then destroys his magical implements, thus setting Ariel free. And the play ends with Prospero's prayer to the audience to set him free. And with that, Grace, I will turn it over to you.
Great. That was a really good summary.
Thank you. I was very relieved
when you said you were going to do it, because there are so many characters in this play. I found the task, just the thought of the task, pretty overwhelming.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
But it's good. So well done. So my first big idea, I thought it would be really interesting to start. Well, I think it's interesting that we're starting this year with possibly the last play that Shakespeare wrote. And so I think that it's going to be even more interesting to start with the last part of this last play. So Prospero's epilogue. So I'm just going to go ahead and read it. It's just a couple of lines. Here we go. Now my charms are all o'erthrown, and what strength I have's mine own, which is most faint. Now 'tis true, I must be here confined by you, or sent to Naples. Let me not, since I have my dukedom got, and pardoned the deceiver, dwell in this bare island by your spell. but release me from my bands with the help of your good hands. Gentle breath of yours, my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please. Now I want spirits to enforce, art to enchant, and my ending is despair, unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free. So I love this epilogue, mainly because you, as the audience, you can kind of see Shakespeare peering out directly at the audience through the character of Prospero. You know, everything has been set to rights in the play. Everybody's got closure. We've got a wedding. But now we see that Shakespeare is well aware of aesthetics, of art, what art is to him. And I suggest that art is relationship for Shakespeare, or at least that's a big element of it. You know, he's written all these magnificent plays. He's done, you know, he's done his work as an artist, but he realizes that he could very well sink into obscurity very, very easily, despite having put all this effort into making his art. So you can see there's a kind of plea here to the audience, just speaking kind of eternally from here on out, that he has done his part of the job, but now it's up to the rest of human history to make his art survive. It reminded me a lot of this part in Etienne Gilson's Painting in Reality, which is a book on the philosophy of aesthetics. And there's a section where he says, you know, you can have like a wonderful piece of music or a wonderful painting, but if nobody's listening to that music at that moment, it doesn't even really exist. Or if nobody's looking at that painting at that moment and appreciating that, then it doesn't even exist. It doesn't really function or fulfill its role or its existence as art itself. And Shakespeare's very aware of that. It also seems like he's aware that he didn't become famous, he didn't become lasting, you know, in his lifetime, even just because of dumb luck or popularity or something like that. He's very respectful towards his audience. I'm just looking at the very solemn language at the end. It says, unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free. There's, you know, kind of a spiritual gravity to the survival of art here. This man was a real artist, and he comprehended the utter gravity of his role on a vocational level, I believe, just throughout the rest of human history. And I think I want to touch on this later, but I do think it's very important that he ends this play, let your indulgence set me free. So just as Prospero needs to find a way to freedom, you know, so does Shakespeare at the very end of this play.
Yeah, I imagine also there's a sense of just desiring a rest from artistic labor. Because being an artist can be, it is so demanding. And like I know you have had this experience of like how, you know, when you're painting your icons, it can be like it's something that you want to do and on a certain level need to do, and that need, I think, as an artist can be difficult to like manage just within the kind of day-to-day demands of being a human. And I think we see that in Shakespeare too. I think there's in some sense a desire for like wanting to rest from the tremendous labor of putting together all of these works that he's left us with. It's kind of like I was reading an article about this Picasso exhibition that's on right now, just of like his doodles stuff, where like he just like couldn't stop making art. So like he'd be at a restaurant and just start like drawing on the tablecloth because he just couldn't, he just had that need to keep creating and keep making things. And I wonder if there's a little of that in Shakespeare as well, like that desire for rest finally. You know, not needing to be the genius at last. But yeah, that's that I feel like is a good way to go into kind of the first thing that I wanted to address, which is the question of beauty in The Tempest. So we get a really interesting sort of case study in The Tempest, just as far as like people who don't have the same experience as the general populace. So in particular, Miranda and Caliban give us these kind of figures who are totally unused to all the rest of most of human society. And both of them give us a lot to think about in terms of beauty. So when, I know you're going to talk about this relationship more, but when Miranda first sees Ferdinand, she's just amazed at the sight of him. And she's always amazed at things. Like her name Miranda means the wondering one. So she's always just in awe of existence. But when she first sees Ferdinand, she says, "I might call him a thing divine, for nothing natural I ever saw so noble." So she's overwhelmed by his beauty, by his appearance, just the fact that he's there. And Prospero, who is of course kind of toying with Ferdinand and Miranda, basically tells her that she just doesn't know any better. So he says, hang on here. He says, "Thou thinkest there's no more such shapes as he, having seen but him and Caliban, foolish wench. To the most of men, this is a Caliban, and they to him are angels." All right, so he's basically saying, look, you just don't know any better. You've only ever seen me and Caliban, and so just any old guy is going to look incredible compared to us, especially to Caliban. But it really gives us an interesting starting point for thinking about beauty, and for trying to figure out how it is as human beings that we access beauty. Because on the one hand, we tend to think that there's a kind of subjectivity to beauty. You know, we have the old adage, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. We have Horace's famous dictum that concerning taste, there's no disputing. You know, either you like something or you don't. But then we also do tend to sense that there are degrees of beauty, that there are kind of degrees to taste. And especially with aesthetic judgments, we tend to speak as though some things are better than others. So like, you know, in general, probably someone's going to say, most people would probably agree that Mozart produces better music than the Wiggles, or something like that.
Let's hope.
Or that Shakespeare produces better poetry than Dr. Seuss. That there's a kind of intensity of being that's contained in certain people, in certain works of art, that is just better than in something else. And if you like something lower more, the fault is then in you rather than in the thing. And we get a sense of that further from Caliban, who is kind of in a similar position to Miranda, in that Miranda, along with Sycorax, is, you know, those are the only two women that he's ever seen. And so later when Caliban is urging Stefano to kill Prospero so that Stefano can become king of the island, Miranda's beauty is one of the main inducements he uses. So he says, "And that most deeply to consider is the beauty of his daughter. He himself calls her a nonpareil. I never saw a woman, but only Sycorax, my dam, and she. But she as far surpasseth Sycorax as greatest does least." So, you know, Caliban basically says that Miranda is the most beautiful creature there is. My mom, Sycorax.
Happy Mother's Day.
Yeah, happy Mother's Day, Mom. You're the least beautiful woman there ever was. And in a sense, of course, this is literally the case. Like, Miranda just is the most beautiful woman right. he has seen, and Sycorax is the least beautiful he's ever seen. But we get a sense that he means something more than that. That he senses, like, there are two ends of a spectrum as far as beauty is concerned. And Miranda is at the top, and Sycorax is at the bottom. And that's, so, very interestingly, that is kind of, that's kind of what someone like St. Thomas Aquinas might tell us about beauty. So Thomas Aquinas says that beauty pertains to a cognitive sense, that the beautiful thing is the thing that pleases us when we see it. So we see something and it pleases us, and that's beauty. And it's kind of, it can strike us as a very simplistic definition. But for Aquinas, first of all, sight kind of stands in for the rest of the senses because it's the highest sense. It's the closest to the cognitive power. It's the one that gives us the most information about the world around us. And so when he uses sight, he's kind of using it for the rest of the senses, because of course we would call Mozart's music beautiful, in addition to, you know, a beautiful sunset, a beautiful painting. So there's this relation between the sensual power, you know, whatever I see or hear, and the ability of my mind to recognize the goodness of it, and to recognize the harmony between the sense experience and the cognitive experience. And so Caliban is getting at what St. Thomas would describe as this kind of generic ordering of things with respect to beauty. So in every grouping, in every category, St. Thomas says that the grouping or genus or substance is organized basically by the parts being organized in terms of their relation to the highest part, and that relationship is established in virtue of what he calls virtual quantity, which is basically the intensity of a thing's being. So Caliban is kind of getting at that sort of virtual quantity, that intensity of being that is present in kind of the highest way in Miranda and in the least way in Sycorax. And so that's, you know, I think that's Shakespeare's getting at, you know, through just kind of these images and through these kind of social experiments that we have in the play, I think at this question of beauty and asking us, you know, how is it that how do we recognize beauty, and how do we see different degrees of beauty across, you know, a whole spectrum of beings around us. And that's kind of, you know, it kind of draws us back to Prospero's speech at the end, you know, just thinking of beauty as that which pleases, having been seen. And Prospero tells us that his aim was to please. His aim, Shakespeare's aim, was to give us something beautiful. And that beauty refers to that kind of harmonious relationship between the sense experience, which Shakespeare gives us so much of, you know, first of all, you know, just in the imagery he gives us, but also in the sound of his language, But the way that that imagery and that sound harmonizes with the intellectual content that he's giving to us. And that seems to be so much of the power of Shakespeare's plays and his ability to harness beauty in a way that's accessible to human beings, in a way that combines the sense and the intellect.
Amen.
Yes. Yeah. So I know that that you wanted to talk some more about freedom,
mm-hmm.
Also about Ferdinand and Miranda.
Yes.
Do you want to comment on those some?
Yes. Well, I love, I don't know, Caliban, and I'm sure this is common, but he's just such a great character to love to hate, and you hate to love him. And there is a sense, like, he is very human, which, when he makes these observations, kind of like with Miranda and Sycorax, they really do make you stop and think. Like, he's not an animal as much as they try to make him out, as much as he tries to make himself to be. And something that kept occurring to me visiting this play was just the notion of freedom and how it seems like every single character wants it, but it seems like very few of them actually understand what it is. And I think that connects with the idea of self-rule, because you've got all these different characters with different levels of power or authority, but they're all, except maybe Miranda, because she's perfect, like they all seem to be struggling in similar, you know, to similar degrees. Not in similar degrees. They're definitely struggling to different degrees, but they're all struggling. And I think kind of the point there is, you know, it doesn't matter if you are a wizard or a king or a duke or some hideous person who gets mistaken for a fish. Like, if you can't rule yourself, then you will never be free. You will never be truly free. And I think Caliban is a great place to start because he so obviously is enslaved to his passions. And yes, he's Prospero's slave. And yes, he enslaves himself to Stefano. But really what it comes down to is he is just a slave to baseness, his own baseness. And I don't know that he ever fully understands that. You know, he's spent the entire play complaining about what a terrible master Prospero is. And then finally, you know, Stefano comes along and gets him drunk and he thinks, wow, this must be freedom. And, you know, the second act ends with Caliban, you know, probably jumping around the stage, yelling, freedom, heyday, heyday, freedom, freedom, heyday, freedom. And Stefano says, oh, brave monster. And you think, well, this is not a loving, respectful relationship in which Caliban will finally be free to, you know, express some autonomy. He's a great place to start for that because he's a terrible example of freedom. Yeah. Or, you know, just a great one of the lack thereof. And then you come to Prospero, who, you know, he's this, you know, he has magical ability. So you'd think, wow, his life is great. You know, he's by himself. He can read as much as he likes. Think that's what he would want because right. That's what he did before. He's got his lovely daughter with him to keep him company. And he's got various magical slaves that can do his bidding and collect his firewood and things like that. But you get the sense that, you know, past all of that unusual stuff, he's kind of just a bitter old man until he comes to the realization that he needs to embrace forgiveness for his own sake, not because he's finagled repentance out of anybody. And once he does that, he is able to, you know, set Ariel free, but really he's free in that sense. And I think also Ariel is such a great character because, and he's such a good foil for Prospero, because there can be the temptation to just think of Prospero as kind of like this magical puppet master for the play, but I don't think that was the intention there. Ariel, by all accounts, seems to be more magical and more unusual than Prospero, but he still longs for freedom. He doesn't have full ability to express his free will until Prospero is able to embrace his own. And it seemed to me the only character who really understood freedom, or certainly talked about it a lot, was Ferdinand. I just interestingly enough, because I don't know, as you know, Ferdinand, I just love Ferdinand and Miranda because they're just so perfect and so cheesy, but I do think there is a good bit of depth to Ferdinand particularly. So for instance, when Ferdinand first meets Miranda and just falls head over heels for her, and Prospero is just such a dad, you know, he's just like, well, you can't talk to my daughter, like, we can't make this too easy on them, so I'm gonna make Ferdinand another one of my slaves, and he'll have to work for me. And Ferdinand, when he realizes what this game is, he agrees to it because he truly loves Miranda. But there's a line, let me see, really at the beginning. So he accepts the fact that he's been shipwrecked, that his father's probably dead. But it says, so all of these sufferings are but light to me. Might I but through my prison once a day behold this maid. All corners else of the earth let liberty make use of. Space enough have I in such a prison. So we get this glimpse right there, which is just... Oh, yeah. You know, like, okay, we get this glimpse here of this man, you know, he's got his priorities straight in his mind. He has enough freedom as long as he can look at Miranda once a day through the window of his prison. And even, you know, when you get to the very end of the play, like right before the, I guess you could call it like the wedding feast, Prospero in full dad mode, you know, kind of tells Ferdinand, now listen up, I'm gonna let you talk to my daughter, but I don't want you to, you know, ruin the wedding night before the wedding night, so to speak. And Ferdinand is like, oh, don't worry, you know, I won't let my liver get the better of me or something. Like, he understands, you know, yes, I feel this great ardor for Miranda and I love Miranda, but I also recognize, you know, there's still this baseness in me that I must constantly be in control of, constantly rise above in order to continue being, to continue maintaining my honor. So I think that that self-sacrifice for the beloved is kind of what Shakespeare is getting at, definitely with Ferdinand's character, just in terms of self-rule.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah, I think that, so you were mentioning that you were struck by how many times the word like freedom, liberty, all this kind of, since freedom comes up in the play, I was struck again and again by how many times the word brave comes up. And of course we get the, you know, the title of Brave New World from one of Miranda's lines in the play. But the word brave just comes up over and over again. Like, it came up in that line that Stefano reads to...
Oh, brave monster.
Yeah, brave monster. And Caliban is talking about... Caliban, when he's talking about Miranda with Stefano, they're talking about her as a brave lass. And Caliban saying that she will get you brave brood. And all these mentions of bravery... and a lot of it centers on Miranda, whether she's using the word, which she does frequently. I think she uses it first when she talks about the brave vessel. out in the storm. But then also, of course, you know, in the Brave New World line. And then she's, you know, people call her brave so often and question her bravery. And so it's really interesting to think about why Shakespeare uses that word so often. And again, you know, kind of looking at it through, you know, kind of a classical philosophy lens, which is probably not fair, but it's the only one I have. So when Aristotle talks about bravery, he talks about it as basically relating to moderating your fear with respect to things that should be feared. And there are things, Aristotle says, that are fearful. And so bravery is not just not feeling fear, but it's basically feeling rightly about fearful situations and reacting to them properly. And he says that the real place where we can demonstrate bravery is with respect to death. So especially in battle, that's the place where we can best demonstrate bravery, because death is imminent. And we see, I think there's a connection to the play in that so much of the bravery with respect to Miranda has to do with death. Of course, when she's observing the ship in the storm, there's a, you know, it seems likely that whoever is on the ship will die. But then also all of these references to Miranda being brave, there's a sense that for everyone on the island, Miranda is the way through death. Because especially if no one is getting off this island, then there's a bunch of men and one woman on the island. And so there's all this talk about who will be king over the island, who will people the island, and all of that comes through Miranda. The only way to people the island is by Miranda, if they're stuck there. And so there's a way in which fear of death is connected with Miranda in that way, as a way to escape death through offspring. And there's a, I forget who said this, but there's a line that the sexual drive is the next generation telling us that we have to die. And so there's that kind of aspect to it. But there's also, I think, in a deeper sense, a way in which Miranda demonstrates the proper openness to the world, the proper way of wondering about the world, and of always being amazed at what the world has to offer. That is one of the best ways to master one's fear. One of the best ways to be properly oriented towards death in the end, and so to be properly brave. I think that ties in a lot with the sense of liberty as well, that there's a liberty in bravery. And in a lot of ways, kind of in the last analysis, like, all of us, of course, face death. And so it's kind of bravery is kind of the ultimate question for us in a lot of ways. But yeah, I know you wanted to address some of the poetry. Of course, that's part of the kind of the other aspect of it that we're wanting to look at, is some of the specifics of the poetry itself. So I'll kick it back to you for that.
All right. I don't know. This is kind of silly, I guess, but I just love Ferdinand and Miranda, how Shakespeare, I think he might have been a bit of a softie. Where he's writing this last play. You know, he could have written anything. He could have written a tragedy or another great history or something like that. And he writes this magical thing. And he has a romance in it where there's no agenda. There's nothing going on. Ferdinand loves Miranda. Miranda loves Ferdinand. And the way they speak to each other is just so innocent and pure and good. It's hilarious in a lot of senses. So I don't know. You just like look at any exchange they have during the play. And you can just, I just die laughing. I know I've told you this before, but it just reminds me of the Disney movie Enchanted, where Disney basically parodies itself, like any Disney princess movie. And, the main character princess, her name is Giselle, and she's supposedly, trying to find her way back to her magical land so that she can marry her Prince Edward. And he's just, the very two-dimensional, cartoony figure. And, there's this moment in the movie where he just thinks he hears her singing to animals or something. And he's just like, Giselle! I can't help but imagine Ferdinand and Miranda are like that, but they mean it. It's real.
Yeah.
And so, you can just fly to any section where they're speaking, but here's one where, Ferdinand is, piling logs for Prospero, and Miranda realizes, oh, this is my dad's 3-hour study time. I'm going to go talk to Ferdinand. And, so they're talking to each other and he tells her, "Hear my soul speak. The very instant that I saw you, did my heart fly to your service. There resides to make me slave to it, and for your sake am I this patient log man." And Miranda replies, "Do you love me?" Ferdinand says, "Oh heaven, oh earth, bear witness to this sound, and crown what I profess with kind event if I speak true. If hollowly, invert what best is boded me to mischief. I, beyond all limit of what else in the world, do love, prize, honor you." And then Miranda just starts crying. She's so happy. So you can see, it's just so delightful. And I just love it. And Shakespeare does not shy away from just the lovey-doveyest kind of love possible. Mm-hmm. But I think the fact that it's so true really does make it beautiful that he's just given us this gift of this perfect couple here in his possibly his last play. I love that he gave that to us.
Yeah, for sure. I'm gonna go back to the other end of the spectrum
with oh, good.
Caliban. Because one of the things about Caliban that makes him so interesting is that he speaks so beautifully. So much of the time, like so much of his dialogue is just really beautiful poetry. And I think that comes from the fact that, of course, he's been educated by Prospero and Miranda. But he just, and of course, he turns it often to bad. And of course, he tells Miranda and Prospero, like, if you taught me to speak, one of the things I'm going to do is curse you with it. And so he's doing some of that here. But it's also just really, really beautiful. So he has this speech. "All the infections that the sun sucks up from bogs, fence, flats on Prosper fall and make him by inchmeal a disease. His spirits hear me, and yet I needs must curse. But they'll nor pinch, fright me with urchins. Shows, pitch me in the mire, nor lead me like a firebrand in the dark out of my way, unless he bid them. But for every trifle are they set upon me, sometime like apes that mow and chatter at me, and after bite me, then like hedgehogs which lie tumbling in my barefoot way and mount their pricks at my footfall. Sometime am I all wound with adders who with cloven tongues do hiss me into madness. Lo, now lo, here comes a spirit of his, and to torment me for bringing wood in slowly, I'll fall flat. Perchance he will not mind me." But there's this really, there's just a real beauty to his speech that just gives, again, sort of a testament to Shakespeare's powers as a poet, and also to the way that Shakespeare can demonstrate the complexity of human beings through the way that they speak. And it's also, we've talked about this a little bit, but reading the play this time made me wonder if there might not be some kind of connection between Caliban and Anthony Blanche in just because, so with both of the characters, they're kind of both on the outskirts of society. And a lot of that shows through the way that they speak. Mm-hmm. So of course Anthony has this affected stutter, his like my da-da-da. And all of that, but that's his stutter is very very much played up, and is very much aligned with like the very beautiful way that he tends to speak. Mm-hmm. We also, of course, like we kind of meet him when he's declaiming the Wasteland from the balcony of Sebastian's rooms. So there's this way in which like Anthony is kind of right at the educated center of language in the same way that Caliban is, and yet they're both very much cast out from society. And it's interesting too that like even just the way that Caliban is always like he's compared to a tortoise or a fish, mm-hmm. or a monster or whatever. And I think there's a shadow of that also even in Anthony, like when he's threatened with being pitched into one of the fountains, mm-hmm. basically being bullied, and he just leans into it and like wants to play in the fountain, kind of play the part of the fish. But yeah, there's, again, I think in a passage like this, Shakespeare just shows us like the full range of humanity in someone who, by all accounts, is kind of like at the very bottom of the scale of humanity, as Caliban sort of is. Did you want to add?
I'm so happy that you brought that up because I think, I don't know, we've talked about this before, but I think you could argue that Anthony Blanche and Caliban both understand, maybe more Anthony than Caliban, but they both understand beauty, but they don't... Mm-hmm. They don't want to follow through to its conclusion in like a moral grounding. So Caliban is offended that he's mistreated and he has a sense of a moral kind of right and wrong in the situation. He is being wronged and he has been wronged, but he doesn't want to follow through to that conclusion because then he couldn't be, he couldn't behave badly anymore. Mm-hmm. And Antony understands beauty. He can identify when a painting is beautiful or when it's just charming.
What do you mean?
Exactly. But he doesn't want to, or even, it clearly bothers him that, some people were bullying him and trying to throw him into a fountain, but he doesn't want to follow that to the conclusion of, well, then I have to stop behaving so badly. So there is a sense in which beauty will not save the world on its own, as much as we love to say that. It's a very romantic thing to say.
Right.
I don't want to get too carried away.
We've got time here. Yeah. No time limit. Yeah, and I think I'm sure we'll address that more. But that is something that's come up a couple times over the course of the conversation here, is that beauty is relational, in a sense where like the beautiful work of art, though there's certainly tremendous value just in the artist having made it, part of the process of making it is making it for others.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you could say whatever you want about art for art's sake, but the fact is that so much of our lived experience of art is communal, whether it's Shakespeare's plays being performed, which is where they really come alive, or in, you know, a painting being being devised for a patron, or whatever. There is this art tends not to happen just in isolation, and there's a difference between kind of beauty and truth, as opposed to just goodness. And I think we can see it even kind of in the, like, in the Genesis creation account, you know, where God speaks something into existence, and there's, just by a thing's existence, it has a unity and a goodness that then doesn't really depend on, like, whether a human being observes it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But then God also saw that it was good. And there, it's in that seeing a thing's goodness that I think the real sort of Thomistic sense of beauty lies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, like, that's where our experience of beauty is in centrally observing the fundamental goodness of a thing and the kind of radiance that it has, of its own being. But yeah, there is, you know, there's also, I think, that sense in which, however much we like to say that beauty will save the world, you know, like, Jesus didn't come and say, I am the beauty.
Right.
Yeah, like he said, like, I am the
he
truth.
He could have, yeah.
Yeah, and there's, right. You know, there's again that relational aspect to truth, but it calls us in a different way than beauty does.
Right.
And there's a way where someone like Anthony Blanche or Caliban can recognize beauty without sort of accepting the truth.
Right.
That beauty reflects in some way.
Right. And it's what is that extremely famous line from Augustine that I'm probably going to butcher? He says, like, late have I loved you, beauty ever ancient, ever new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you could argue, Augustine being a very intelligent person, you could argue he very well understood beauty before he became a Christian, truly. But it's the loving part. Late have I loved you.
Mm-hmm.
And all that implies, all the, I don't know, just all of that.
Yeah.
That implies.
For sure. Very good.
To conclude very eloquently.
Excellent. Yes. Well, thank you all for joining us on this first real episode of the Shakespeare Birthday Party. We'll be continuing next time with Much Ado About Nothing, which I am deciding right now.
Excellent.
Just so that you all know where to look next time. Yeah, of course, these episodes are obviously not meant to be any kind of comprehensive study of each of the plays. We do not have the time, energy, or expertise for
scholarship,
any of that. But it's just an attempt for us to read the plays, to engage in a discussion about them, that at least starts to scratch the surface and get a conversation going. And I'm sure that conversation will deepen and develop over the course of this year. So, thank you all for joining us. This has been the Shakespeare Birthday Party. Happy birthday, and we will see y'all next time.